I'm Sean Graham, and what's old as news this week is the Canadian Armed Forces purge. Through the second half of the 20th century, the Canadian Armed Forces purged members of the LGBTQIA+ community from its ranks. This was done through a systematic effort of finding individuals who were homosexual and subjecting them to intense interrogations, and then ultimately purging them from the military. And this was done under an administrative order that had specific definitions for homosexuality and sexual deviancy. And thousands and thousands of Canadian Armed Forces members were subjected to this and lost their careers. And that is the subject of the upcoming Shannon Lecture Series this Monday night, November the 24th, at the Dominion Chalmers Center, titled Purging the Canadian Military of Sexual Deviance, the War on 2S LGBTQIA+ Members and Their Partners from the 1960s to the Present. And this will be Lynn Golliker and Carmen Poulin delivering this lecture. They've done a lot of research interviewing members who were purged from the forces, so they'll be going through some of their interviews with members and their family members and what the implications are, or were, and are, for those members and their families. So in advance of that lecture, I was very fortunate to have the opportunity to talk with Lynn and Carmen. Really enjoyed the chat. Thank you, Will, as well. So let's get right to my discussion with Lynn Golliker and Carmen Poulin. All right, and Lynn Golliker and Carmen Poulin join me now. Lynn and Carmen, how are you doing today?
Great.
Great as well.
Terrific. Yeah, very, very excited to chat with you today. In advance of your lecture as part of the Shannon series coming up on Monday, the 24th of November, entitled Purging the Canadian Military of Sexual Deviance, the War on 2S LGBTQIA+ Members and Their Partners from the 1960s to the Present. So before we get into some of the specifics of the lecture and the things we'll be talking about on Monday, just what is this out of in terms of the broader research project? And Lynn, maybe if we want to start with you and then Carmen can jump in, just sort of the broader project that this lecture is based on.
Actually, it's based on two projects, one that both had CHIRC funding, and the previous one that ended when we stopped collecting data in 2010 was the first one where we interviewed 126 members of the military, people that had been lost their jobs, and actually their spouses, we would call them that, the modern term. Partners back then, any word that you could use to disguise yourself. And now we're in the midst of quote-unquote redoing that project, although it's expanded a lot because now back in when we first did the first one, there was lesbians, gays, bisexuals and trans. The last two, there was not as many out and about, if I put it that way, whereas now we have the 2S LGBTQIA+ group. So we have a much larger group, and we're in the midst of closing in on the end of that project of data gathering, just to confirm data gathering.
Right. And Carmen, could you speak a little bit to how you are engaging in outreach to folks? I know there are networks across the country. The Rainbow Veterans of Canada is a wonderful organization that I've read some of what's come out of them and their group. But specifically, how are you engaging with folks?
That's a really good question. It's very different between the two studies Lynn described, because when we did the first study, there was no social media to speak of. Like we are, there was email, but that was about it. And there was no Facebook or whatever else kind of group that we could tap into very easily. So at that time, it was mostly word of mouth. And the only reason why we could start that study to begin with was because Lynn had been in the military for 16 years. But now to jump to today, we have used all sorts of different sites. We asked different sites to advertise. But to be honest, the best way still to recruit is by word of mouth. The main difference, I would say, is that we've had the pandemic in between. And what that means is that now people are comfortable doing interviews over the virtual reality, such as in Zoom or Microsoft. But I'm coming to talk about this just because at that time, no one would have trusted to talk about that at the time in any other way than if we had been right sitting in front of them with all the doors locked. Whereas now, because of society, because of where we're at, because of how the military has had to change, people will talk a bit more freely, though it's not 100% still today. There's still a lot of hesitation in different ways and by different people.
And how much, if at all, do you think the formal apology that the military and the government of Canada put forward, and things like the Pride patch or the Rainbow Veterans patch, the badge that was created, do things like that affect the way your research is conducted in terms of people potentially being more comfortable, more willing to speak with you, recognizing some of these public ways that the CAF is trying to change?
I think given that when we did the first study, many, if not most of our participants didn't necessarily know that it was no longer illegal to be fired. And we had started our research just after, a little bit after that famous 1992 case, the Michel Douglas case. But they didn't really know. It wasn't advertised that the military was no longer discriminating legally or officially. Yeah, that's... I don't know if you want to continue on that, Lynn.
I think, like Carmen said, we could reach out to people and find them on various... not just Facebook, various sites, and by word of mouth. Because of the marginalized group and how small it is in the military, the research, we always go on anonymity and confidentiality no matter what, even if the person would want to be out. But they don't want to be out anyway. Yeah. So they're still, in that sense... they're still very protective and it's various reasons, but, you know, you can just think of career. It could be direct harassment from their colleagues if they found out, per se. So there's various reasons why they still and do remain and want that anonymity and, you know, our confidentiality in terms of we had to build that trust with them even today.
And I should just pick up on when Lynn, you're saying that they don't want to. Of course, they'd want to. We all want to be transparent about our reality. That's not the real question. In a way, it's do they feel safe to be really out? And like Lynn said, it's not everyone. There are some people that wouldn't mind for us to use their name, but it's still very few. Very, very, very few. And there are good reasons for that, right? The past is predictive of the future, typically, although sometimes that doesn't hold, but typically. And there's too much of a history of discrimination in the military still for those people to feel completely at ease being completely out. Doesn't mean that immediately in their, like, that they don't have colleagues that with whom they're okay with talking about the fact that, you know, they're going home to their partner, but that's not all of them, and it's not maybe to the same degree as if they're straight.
Right. So you mentioned the history of this, and the thing that you're going to be talking about, or one of the things you'll certainly come up on Monday night, is the Canadian Forces Administrative Order that made homosexuality, said that it was incompatible with service. I'm sort of interested in this, in that my job at the Directorate of History and Heritage involves going through a lot of old orders, including administrative orders. So it was interesting to read this particular one. And what struck me is that there's an actual formal definition for homosexuality within the actual order itself, which the order defines as, quote, one who has a sexual propensity for persons of one's own sex. And it also makes sense to, or makes reference to sexual abnormality, which talks about things that are against the Criminal Code of Canada. But for the purposes of your study, how important is that administrative order? And then we'll start with you, just in terms of understanding the way in which the Canadian Forces defined homosexuality and the protocols and procedures that were put in place per that administrative order.
You know, if you read through, and I smile on this because, you know, I revisited, and I think it's been amended at least two or three times, I think, over the years that it was actually in effect, but in different ways. But, and I was reading through this one, and I was looking at the parameters, you know, of what they should do and how they should carry out investigations and how it should happen. And all of the stories and all of the interviews don't correspond to any of it. I just want to say that, right. you know, and I'd forgotten about that, you know, so that the subject will be, will not be caused, will have minimal embarrassment. No, I think... They usually called in the SIU, the Special Investigative Unit, and that was interrogations. And embarrassment was the rule.
Right.
So, you know, when I'm reading through this, I just think, oh, wow, they just handled it so differently in practical ways. That it's, and I think in the end, I think that's why the realization that this order, they had done such terrible things to service members, to their own people, that they don't, it doesn't even fit. If you read this and think, well, how are they doing this? That's what I was just shocked when I reread it myself.
One of the things, and we were told at some point that this was too provocative to put in an article, but if you read in the Criminal Code of Canada what happens when somebody is taken hostage, it actually was basically what went on. So if you can imagine in the cheapest movies, you know, with the light bulb hanging without any cover, and a room no larger than a broom area, you know, or maybe it depends on your broom closet, but, you know, very, very small. Enough room for maybe two chairs on one side and one chair on the other, because, of course, they were there on their own. There was no legal representation with them, no rights or whatever. And they were kept there for as long as the SIU decided that they wanted to keep them there. And it could go on for days, where they would pick them up, drive them there, keep them there all day, drive them back. And it could be on a recurring basis, so that it would be every week or every 3 weeks or every 3 months, this would start again. So the description had nothing to do with any respect or discomfort. It was just uncomfortable from the get-go. And I think the other aspect that many of our participants spoke of is that when this happened, when they had been kicked out for many years, let's say, they were young. They were very young and very intimidated by the whole process. And the military works on the basis of orders, you know, yes, sir, no, sir. And how high should I jump, sir? And so rights, you know, the kind of rights that we see in some movies that, you know, well, I'm not going to talk to you until my lawyer's there, don't exist in those people's mind. And they don't have access to it anyway.
Given how sort of intense that process was, and that you're talking about the way in which they were interrogated, was there kind of a... like in the people you're talking to, did they talk about support from each other? Was there almost like this underground network? Did they have anything that they could do kind of beyond the gaze of the military, that they could find supports for each other either before, during, or after going through this experience?
Based on our data, it was very different for the men, the gay men, and for the women. And based on personal experience, because I was in the military during the purge, if the women would sit in barracks and talk, if they could, if they were comfortable enough. And there were groups, not all of them did, and they would say what to say and not to say. So there was some of that that did go on. And that's based on personal experience. Based on our data, though, it also shows that many women didn't connect. Many women, if they were in a relationship, their spouse would, some of them had the door slammed in their face because they did not want to be implicated. Their friends would stop talking to them because they did not want to be implicated. And if you go back to that CFAO 19-20 and reread it, and this didn't get amended, I think, until into the mid-80s, I can't remember exactly. It says, if a person subject to the code of service discipline, which is another military member at any rank level at all, so your own friend, colleague, wearing the same uniform, if they become aware or suspect that you're a homosexual, so it's based on that definition, simple definition, they were supposed to report you. So it was actually the entire military was ordered to report on each other. So, you know, it's incredible when you think of it like that. And some people knew that at a gut level, that they didn't want to be associated. So it become very isolating for some people. Like I explained, that there was these little pockets that could talk, because I witnessed that personally, but our data does show that some were super isolated. It's like until they actually got booted, left, the military released them, they basically they couldn't talk to people. People didn't want to be implicated.
What, if any, effect is there of the broader situation for the Canadian Forces through 70s and 80s, where this isn't a time where, you know, recruitment is necessarily the highest priority, right? Things are being cut across the Canadian Armed Forces. And I'm just wondering that if you go back and look at some cases, say in the Second World War, there are commanding officers who just, you know, turn a blind eye. There are cases where commanding officers don't turn a blind eye when they find cases of homosexuality as well. But is there anything to say here about discrimination being stronger or having a more systemic form in the Canadian Forces, and that's allowed by budget cuts and the fact that we're not recruiting heavily, and I'm just wondering if discrimination in this forum is allowed to thrive given the broader trend of the Canadian Armed Forces through the era of the purge?
I would like to just start off with saying that it's more the era of the Cold War that shaped or that colored that whole period, because why this whole order was developed supposedly was because homosexuals were supposed to be weak in character and they could be blackmailed by the Russians or the Soviet Union, I should say. And it's worth mentioning that during that whole time, and that wasn't, before I finish that sentence, it wasn't just for the military, it was also for the RCMP and the public sector. But there was never a case of we heard of or whatever that ever found anything like that taking place. The people they had to fear was within, not from outside. So, like, if you were gay, this was the fear, was not to be, found out, basically. But I think that colored the justification, as well as at the time, the research that supported this whole undertaking, this whole thing about the fruit machine and how there were people at your university, your university actually, that were directly involved with the development of the fruit machine, which was a ridiculous undertaking. But at the time, in all fairness, in psychology, that the belief that, you know, measuring some of the physiological response, such as the size of the pupil or the galvanic skin response, could lead you to identify with some level of objectivity who were the gays and who weren't, you know. But I mean, we've luckily have gone a little bit further than that in our understanding of responses.
Can I want to draw our attention to one thing, and I want to talk about intersectionality. And this is not usually talked about, and I often wonder why, but there was a commission done on the status of women that ended in 1970. And there was, I think, 6 recommendations to change things for women specific to the Canadian military. The Canadian military saw its largest increase percentage-wise right up to 1990 for women. So they wanted women in the military. However, we're talking about a men-dominated, a warrior, hyper-masculine, patriarchal institution that did not want women. And I say that with emphasis. The intersectionality, and I would go out as far to say that's held up in the data as well, that women, they wanted women out, and being a lesbian was an easy way to get them out. One of the easy way. And if, again, I come back to that, you know, if somebody suspects, well, somebody could just say she's a lesbian and not question that person. Why do you suspect? So I just want to, you know, all of this bears out that it's one way of getting and keeping women under check, because, you know, we still ask that question, where is the percentage of women at? You know, they're still not there. So, but in that time, it was extremely hard to be a woman in the Canadian Armed Forces because you weren't welcome. You weren't wanted. I don't know if they still are, but that's another question for the future. But I just want to bring that out because we don't seem to talk about that in the literature, and we don't seem to talk about that intersectionality in this particular case as well.
So one of the things that you're doing in your research and certainly in this lecture as well is also looking at the family members of members of the Canadian Forces who were purged and subject to this discrimination. I'm curious, just methodologically, how do you go about that process, and how do you try to quantify the impact of what happens to a partner of an individual who is discriminated against and who is purged and has to go through all this? How do you kind of try to put those experiences and quantify them in your research?
Well, I should start off by saying that we don't do quantitative research. I'm a psychologist. I'm trained in quantitative research. So is Lynn in sociology. But we do qualitative interviews. So right off the bat, we just do enough interviews that people don't question us as right. to the validity of our data, because yeah. we have extensively large samples, because we need them in order to do policy and applied research. So, you know, I need to start there. But in terms of quantification, I would rather say in terms of what happened simply to the family, it's enormous. When you can imagine that people got fired out of the blue, and we had, this is a poignant example, we had members of families of former military members who had committed suicide after being kicked out. And they called us when we were doing the first study because they wanted their family member to be part of our study and their story. They wanted them to be counted. So, you know, the impact on, I've lost some members of my family. Most of us have at a certain age. And, you know, that's tragic, especially when it's a suicide. But so that's part of it. The other part is in terms of the impact on not just, you know, the family, but we had people, partners, talking to us about having to leave their work on the basis of a posting when it makes no sense that they would be leaving their work. And so, for instance, if you're a partner of a military member and you keep moving, at those time also the posting were more frequent than they are now. And if you leave when you've gone up a little bit in your organization, wherever you're working, you have to drop out. So that on the professional level, the cost is enormous. On the long term, it's enormous because your pension is going to be affected when you're older and so on and so forth. The other aspect is that there's no good explanation. So if you're closeted, which many of our participants were, and they're closeted, including with their family, they will leave to go, let's say we've got somebody in Saint-Jean, Quebec, who's partnered with a military woman, and her partner is posted in Cold Lake, and she has to tell her family, I want to go to Cold Lake, just the place I want to go. I don't speak English, but I'd love to go to Cold Lake, even though I have a great job here and I'm happy with my friends. And so we break the ties with the family, we break the ties with friends so that there's no more support. So there's an enormous isolation cost to the family. There are also other people who also had children. And in order to move, they've had to leave the children behind with their ex-partner, if, you know, in terms, and we've had cases of that because they couldn't, you know, in those days, there was no way they would get the ability to keep the children. And it would just split the arrangement if it was a friendly arrangement, and it would split everything if it was an antagonistic kind of separation. So the level of the depth of the cost for a partner was so huge. And the other piece, after that I'll stop, is that they don't exist for the military at that time. They are invisible. There is no rights whatsoever because they don't exist. They cannot exist because that will take away the career of their partner if it comes out. So it's just a crazy situation, really, if you think about it in practicality on an everyday, you know, what's your life? It's your family, it's your job, it's your circle of support, friends and whatever. And it's where you live. You belong to a place in terms of, you know, the environment. And all of a sudden you leave everything and you find yourself no job, not even the language. On some cases, people who would move to Quebec or people who will move away from Quebec and did not have the second language. I mean, it's tragic in terms of what they had to give up. And some of them were amazing in being creative at finding solution. That's the part that we need to also acknowledge. Otherwise, it wouldn't be fair. And, you know, asking their companies, if they worked for companies, to figure out a way to have a transfer. I mean, they did a lot of gymnastics, but that all is a cost. It's time, it's energy, it's emotionally very difficult. Okay, I'll stop saying.
I'll just add two things. One thing is, if, you know, I think at that time and even today, being a spouse of a military member is difficult. I think now the military acknowledges that and tries to supply supports to do that. So I want to mention that is extremely difficult. And so that just would have been amplified for these men and women, civilians that were partnered at that time. The amplification is just beyond any of it. So as Carmen said, they were totally invisible. And I think just having in that invisible sense, trying to maintain a relationship between same-sex couples was you're faced already with the military environment, and then you throw on this clandestine relationship where you can't exist. So I would just say that's probably not a good success rate, or wouldn't be a good success rate. So I'm just reflecting then on the civilian partner. If she moves for the military person, which they did, if that relationship ends, then she's caught. She can't talk to most people because she's not come out to anybody. So, and she's left in the cold because that relationship has just disappeared on her. So again, you know, her networking and what's happening for those women. And even today, those people, I was in the military. I was a lesbian in the military at the time. Even though we might have been out, and even now today, people recognize it. They recognize that I was in and that I was, you know, part of that group. But they never ask about the spouses. They never ask about our romantic relationships, as if those don't or never did exist. So that really has really hit me at home now. In terms of how invisible that group has been in history, they're like still invisible. Nobody stops to ask the question, well, weren't you in a relationship? Was it with a civilian? Was it with a military? Well, if it was a civilian, well, whatever happened, and try and understand, like when you said the cost to that person, they're invisible. They have never been acknowledged. The apology happened. I don't think anybody talked about spouses of the 2S LGBTQIA plus military members that suffered discrimination. And I find that sad. And the three organizations that, you know, that the class action suit was about, military, civil service, and RCMP. Hmm. I find that tragic that piece of history is so invisible, so gone. And I'll stop there, you know.
Yeah, certainly, you know, relationships between members of the military and civilian partners don't need any more stresses, right? There's already enough, and sort of throwing on more in these cases, yeah, as you're talking about the success rate of these relationships. Go ahead.
Can I just add one thing? And it's on a website. It's called, the organization is True Patriot Love Organization. You may have heard of them. And they've got multiple things on there. And the one thing that really struck me is when somebody puts on the uniform, becomes a military member, the whole family serves. Hmm. If there's family, the whole family serves. So I would say that was historically there and still there today. And I think it really describes it.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. Yeah, they do wonderful work there at True Patriot Love. Absolutely. So again, the lecture is coming up on a Monday night, the 24th of November. For both of you, just real quick, obviously we don't want to spoil too much of what's going to be in the lecture because we want people to come out to the Dominion Chalmers Center or to watch online if you're not in the National Capital Region or can't make it out in person. It will be streamed live and available afterwards as well. But for the two of you, what is the legacy of the Purge as it relates to current serving members? And if a current serving member were to come to you and say, like, tell me why the Purge is important for me to know as a member here in 2025, like for each of you, and Carmen, if you want to go first, what would you tell them?
I used to teach the history of psychology. So I've got history as a big piece in my love for different areas. And I always start off the semester telling them that unless we understand what happened before us, the history, we will repeat the same mistakes. And I think, you know, right now is a perfect time to exemplify that. When we just look at south of the border, the situation for 2S LGBTQIA down there, is really, really not great. And it's not great if you are from that group, such as Lynn and I, and we haven't come out, but we will do that. We are a couple, actually, in life, as well as collaborators for years. And we won't go to the States, not just because politically we wouldn't want to go to the States, but because it's dangerous for us. And we have been asked to do talks in the States and have had to turn those down. And the people that ask us, you know, understand the difficulty, but we don't trust the passing at the border. So I think the legacy for us is to, or at least, yeah, is to understand a few things. One is that we need to understand our history in order to avoid future mistakes. The other aspect is that if this hadn't changed, if we hadn't evolved like we did in Canada, we would still be in the same boat as those people that have served during the purge. They would lose their job, they would be frozen in their position or whatever, and all of what came in terms of trauma and so on, and in feeling closeted and the unhealthiness of that reality would be still alive. That's the importance of understanding what went on. And finally, I think, well, for us being social scientists, it's a good example of what we can do with social science research. We can impact what happens, and we have to be really flexible in terms of how we do that. We, at some point, we were saying yes to so many things, you know, that I never would have imagined doing as a social scientist person, but, you know, we'll turn your results into a play. Sure, love that. We'll do posters and, you know, to publicize this in X places or that place. We're going to have a series of hero. We want you to be featured in this. And, you know, those are things that, I don't know about you, but social scientists don't necessarily like to be in the limelight of those things. And the last thing I personally wanted was to be a poster child on this. And I used to always start my talk for many time in saying that Lynn had dragged me by the hair or the ears to do this research, because I was absolutely not going to do this and be involved in that. So I think, you know, you have to be flexible, you have to be open. And for us, in the type of research that we do, we have a very small objective. We just want to change the world. So, you know, we'd like to make this world a better place and a safer place for everybody. And we saw how our research could actually play a role in that. So I think those are all lessons that I think we sometimes resist that. And, you know, we had to learn to do media interviews, and so did the people who survived the purge, whatever position they were in. Those who spoke publicly about their experience, did the present people in the military and their families a huge, huge favor, and at a personal cost, because reliving all of that trauma is something that you can't ask someone to do forever. And some people have done some of it and they won't anymore because it's too difficult. So I think we've learned so much through doing this study, and we still are learning a lot. And I think that it's important for us to talk about it and to reach as many people as possible, because I don't think we realize the potential sometimes of what we're doing. So, you know, and we'll talk a little bit more about this at the time of the lecture for sure. And we really look forward to it.
Yeah. Lynn, was there anything you wanted to add to that?
No, I think Carmen covered it quite eloquently. And like she said, we can speak more to it at the lecture next week as well. Because I think she covered it quite adequately. But I think there's probably a little few other tidbits that could be added, but we'll just save them.
Yeah, we'll say come on out on Monday night, November the 24th. It is at the Dominion Charles Center, which is not on the main Carleton campus. It's downtown, but it is part of Carleton University. The title, Purging the Canadian Military of, quote, Sexual Deviance, end quote, The War on Two SLGBTQIA Plus Members and Their Partners from the 1960s to the Present. Lynn Golliker, Carmen Poulin, very much looking forward to the talk on Monday night. And thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much, Sean.
Thank you, Sean. Appreciate it.
So there you have it, my chat with Lynn Golliker and Carmen Poulin. I thank the two of them for their time. And with that, let's get right to today's historical headline of the week, which today comes from the Toronto Star, an article by Brian Bradley entitled, She Was Among Those Purged from Canada's Military. Today, Michelle Douglas looks back on the pain and the progress. This is from April 2, 2023, in which Brian Bradley talks with Michelle Douglas about her experience and the progress that the Canadian Armed Forces is trying to make in this area. It's certainly not perfect, but efforts are being made. So this is a reflective piece by Brian talking with Michelle about her experience and looking back as well as looking forward. So I won't go too much into it, just a link down there in the show notes as always. Do check it out. Wonderful piece from Brian Bradley in the Toronto Star. Again, she was among those purged from Canada's military. Today, Michelle Douglas looks back on the pain and progress. Today's historical headline of the week. And with that, I'll say thank you so much for listening, everybody. If you have not yet, please do subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, like, great comment, all that good stuff. We've been hit and miss here through the fall. I have been on the road a bunch. This might sound a little different. In a hotel in Halifax right now. In the past couple weeks, I've been fortunate enough to go coast to coast, east to west, in this beautiful country of ours. I've been in 8 of the provinces or something. So really having a wonderful fall in terms of getting to see this, see the country. But it's been a little harder to get the podcast going each week. So I thank everyone for their patience. But should be more regular moving forward. Getting it out as we get into the end of the year here and certainly looking ahead to January. So please do subscribe. Of course, do come on out Monday night, November the 24th at the Dominion Chalmers Center for the talk, the last session of the Shannon Lecture Series for 2025. And as always, do head on over to activehistory.ca. Great written material over there on the website. Plus, all of our past episodes are in the podcast tab. If you want to let me know what you want to hear on the show, it's oldestnews at gmail.com. So with that, I'll say thank you so much for listening, everybody. We'll be back with you again soon with more What's Old Is News.